articulated better, and we'll talk about those as we go through it. So the first one, if you'll notice, is called I've got two in each category, two biblical problems, two theological problems, and two philosophical problems. And the first biblical problem has to do with the events of the Exodus. Now, the issue on the events of the Exodus is that you can't find dead bodies of the charioteers chasing the Israelites under any place over there. I mean, you hear rumors of, you know, wheels that have fallen off chariots and they show up in films. I just cannot find anything about it in the inscriptional data. I just flat can't find anything of that. There's not a lot of archaeological data. If you imagine a tremendous horde of Israelites passing through sand dunes, they're not going to leave a lot of enduring footprints. Let's put it this way. And when you have a nation that consistently erases its bad news out of its newspapers, as ancient Egypt did, every time a new king would come, a new pharaoh would come, he would go back and literally chisel the name of his predecessor out of the monument. He would literally go destroy and desecrate their tombs. There was no grit newspaper. It was the opposite. All you had was bad news. You know, all you had was good news about the current reigning champion, so to speak. So it would be difficult to face the humiliation that was encountered by slave people overcoming with this monolithic deity who just happened to not be the pharaoh, and all the multitudes of gods in Egypt were defiled in this process. Most of the 10 plagues were specifically pointed at the frog god or the lice god or the Nile god, and there was deliberate polemic involved in this, quite comical. The pharaoh, he was god, and his firstborn was killed. I mean, every one of these, there's a deliberate point about this in the theological to make a point that there is only one God. And he happens to be the God of the Israelites at that time in history. So as they leave, this is a very embarrassing moment. We'll talk about literary records now. Remember when I said you can't find stuff in the rocks? It's hard to find stuff in the rocks. There's some data that's highly disputed, but there's still stuff they're arguing about. But we have two kinds of data about the past. We have archaeological data, stuff you dig up, you know, rocks and stones, and then there's literary data. This is what somebody has written down about it back then. Okay. Now we have for example, there's a lot written about the Exodus in this book. Okay. There's a lot. That's a literary piece of data. And so people will sometimes disclaim that and say, it can't be right, it's biased, blah, 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 whatever. Okay. But it does constitute a literary document. Now there are other literary documents about the Exodus that one needs at least consider. Okay? And I'm going to give you a couple of these from ancient literature. Now, we start to get scientific history writers about 400 BC in Greece. So, but you have a realm of, you know, Herodotus and these types that go through Thucydides that are ancient history writers. And they're not as rigorous, quote unquote, as we like to presume that we are in the modern age. But they do have some canons of veracity, and they do their best. They travel. They're big on eyewitness reports and things of this type. And there are a couple of these that I just want to mention that have to do with the Exodus. Okay? One is from Diodorus Siculus. He's a Roman historian, and he's largely a geographer, and he collects legend and folklore. And there's a passage, and he's writing in the first couple of centuries of the Christian era. And in book 3, he's describing the geography of Palestine, Egypt, and Arabia. And he has this curious little passage in here called, in book 3. And I'm just going to read from it in the English. And among the ichthyography, however you say that tribal name, I don't know, it just starts with ichthy, which means fish, presumably. But it's a people right on the other side of what we think was the Red Sea, where the crossing was. But that's the ichthyophagi. Now, among the ichthyophagi who dwell nearby, has been handed down a tale which has preserved the account received from their forefathers, that once, when there was a great receding of the sea, the entire area of the Gulf, which was what may be roughly described as the green appearance, become land, and that after the sea had receded to the opposite parts and the solid ground in the depths of it had emerged to view, a mighty flood came back upon it and return the body of water to its former place. Now, I don't know about you, but I think of a very specific biblical event called the parting of the Red Sea, described here. It may be, there may be other cases where the Red Sea was parted and they're describing something else. Okay, could be. Okay? But these are the people on the other side. Because you've got to think, who would see this? Well, the charioteers aren't going to live to tell about it. And the government's not going to cover it up pretty heavily. So all you've got are both the Israelites, we got their testimony, and then anybody on the other side of the ocean that survived this thing called the Ichthyo something another. Right? Now, and people, there's a little footnote in this. This is the Lord Classical series. There's a little footnote that says, older commentaries saw in this a memory of the Exodus event. See? Now, is that conclusive evidence? No, but didn't we talk about conclusive evidence last week? About it's a trend line. You say, how else am I going to explain this, that situation? The first scientific historian of Egypt was Manetho. His name was Manetho. He wrote right around the time of Christ, a little bit before Christ. He was the first gatherer. It was an Egyptian. He wrote in Greek, and he described a lot of... We don't have his books. His books are always cited somewhere else. You know, somebody, Josephus writes about him, or Julius Africanus, or the anti-Semite Apion. I mean, he's quoted, and this is the way we know we build his book together, on the basis of quotations as best we can. Okay. Now, in one of the citations where somebody's quoting him, around 200 A.D., you have this passage, Cosmos. Those who have written histories of Egypt, that is, Manetho, Cerimon, Apollonius Molon, Lysimachus, something, and the grammarian Apion, have mentioned Moses and the exodus of the children of Israel from Egypt. Okay? Now, a lot of these ancient historians, we don't necessarily believe, we don't know a lot about what they know about legend and whatever, this type. But when they start saying that there were historians ahead of them that described these events, see, that's a little easier to say. This is somebody doing bibliographic work. See, it's a little easier to believe that kind of work than legends about Manetho, for example, said Moses, that the Egyptians were that the Israelites were expelled from Egypt because they were all leprous. Okay, so Manetho says this, and that Moses was a troublemaker that pushed them out because they were all lepers. Right? He's confused about 100 years worth of that. There was a period where there were Egyptians that were a leper colony that were exiled. But Manetho's looking back, you know, a millennium and or two back on this thing. Right? And he's also dealing with records of priests and hearsay. And he says that. And he talks about when he's talking about from the priestly records, which has to do with the Exodus. So Manetho is an Egyptian. He talks about Moses. He talks about the Exodus. He talks about the number of miracles. Manetho has this interesting phrase that I understand to be Joseph. But he says, and then a blast of God smote us, for what reason I do not know. And then the Asiatics came in and took over our country, basically. Now, the Asiatics are commonly understood to be the Hyksos. They were Amorite peoples from Palestine. But something had so weakened the nation, and I think about Joseph and the drought and the famine. They stayed alive, subsistence living. Okay? But it was still too easy for the Hyksos to come in as apatorrent and despoil the country and take it over. Without it fighting a battle, is what he said. Without fighting a battle, this occurred. So we do have some literary data about this. And then there's a third piece that's newly in discussion, and it's a papyri from Egypt called the Apuwer Papyrus. And it is dated roughly around the time that an early date of the Exodus, around the 15th. It's written in a certain period of about 1600 to about 1400. Somewhere in here is our latest copy is there. Some people say it was all the way back to 2000, but nobody can find a historical reference for the things that Apuwer describes. Apuwer is a sage, and he's writing, he's basically whining about the state of Egypt, whining about the government, whining about robbery, whining about famine, whining about all these Asiatics in here, whining about things that are turning over. And he's also going to end up blaming it on his God, who's apparently ineffectual. Okay? Now, he's an Egyptian sage. And let me just read a couple of the quotes from this papyrus. Okay? Now, I'll also talk about where you have to take it with a grain of salt. The doorkeepers say, the servants say, let us go plunder our masters. Okay, now, for those of you that are familiar with the Exodus story, you'll see resonance here of the things that I've picked. Foreigners have become in power everywhere. The servant takes what he finds. Poor men have become men of wealth. Every town says, let us expel our rulers. Lo, the river has become blood. And as one drinks of it, one shrinks from people and thirsts for water. Lo, there are no real people anywhere. Gold, lapis lazuli, silver and turquoise, carnelian, amethyst stone are strung on the necks of female slaves. Remember how the Egyptians plundered and asked for the jewelry from their masters? Exhausted are the materials for every kind of craft. The trees are gone. Lacking are grain, various types of wood. Our craftsmen cannot do anything. Groanings throughout the land mingled with laments. Those who were people, Egyptians only considered Egyptians people. Everybody else was sort of a shadow. So when they say the people, when they say there were people, those who were people are strangers. That means they've lost power, basically, what that means. Whom one shows the way. Foreigners are skilled in the works of the Delta. That means they've taken over local administrative offices. Trees are felled, branches are stripped. All the beasts, their hearts weep, cattle bemoan the state of the land. No face is bright, there's hunger all around. Grain is lacking on all sides. Everyone says there's nothing. The king has been robbed by beggars. The residence is fearful from want. The nobles were expelled from the royal mansions, civil unrest. The poor of the land have become rich. The man of property is a pauper. And the commentator here, by the way, makes this comment. Generally, it's a skeptical commenter. This is ancient Egyptian literature, just classical textbooks. The description of chaos in the admonitions, this text is the admonitions of Apiwub, is inherently contradictory, hence historically impossible. On the one hand, the land is said to suffer from total want. On the other hand, the poor are described as having become rich, of wearing fine clothes, and of generally disposing of all that once belonged to their master. Okay? Now, if those of you familiar with the Exodus account, that sort of says it all. The land was desecrated. The hail just brought down all the trees, all the stuff. The cattle, a few, only those that were inside. There's tremendous civil unrest that would have occurred because the government was so powerless to do anything, and they were stubborn. Remember how even their priests said, forget it, Pharaoh, you've lost your mind. Egypt is ruined, was their phrase, right? And then that night of the Exodus, all the slaves, the Israelites, plundered the Egyptians. They went to them and asked for jewelry, and they gave them all this jewelry, and then they left. And the nation is just in shambles with 1.5 million leaving, all the slave labor. Total chaos. It would be the only situation where you'd have total want and slaves becoming rich. The plundering of the Egyptians. Now, does anybody accuse this of being for the Exodus? Yeah, some people say that that's sort of an eyewitness account, or at least a remembrance of it. Somebody's complaining about it. Somebody that wasn't on the inside, but knew exactly the battles between Moses and Pharaoh. It fits a little bit. It fits a little bit. It's hard to date this. Not tight enough. It's just possibly supporting evidence, like the Manetho thing, possibly supporting evidence, like Diodorus Siculus possibly is. Literarily, we do have data to support that kind of thing. We have a problem with how to date this thing, you know, where you put it. But if you'll compare some of the comments I made there, what I read from, with the stories in Exodus, you can see some recollections and some things that match up. So we don't have, like I say, hard and fast, quote-unquote, archaeological data. As, like I say, it's not predictable that you would have a lot from that kind of thing. But we do have literary remains of that. A lot of literary goes way back there. It's very difficult to find an alternate explanation why the quote-unquote, story of the Exodus is so deeply rooted in the Palestinian mindset, so deeply rooted in the history of Israel, and the Arabs, for that matter. They have the same tradition. And so it's difficult to see how that, apart from it being a real historical event, that could have gotten there. So that's the first issue. We still, like I say, archaeologically, we have some basis to go on, but we're still digging over there. We're still digging stuff up. Okay? The second one was the eyewitness testimony polemic and memory retention. So this is a new challenge that's occurred about the New Testament. We have defended the New Testament documents for a long time as looking like eyewitness reports. So when you look at Matthew and Mark, for example, the amount of detail and the minutiae that's in there and sort of the accidental local color stories all fit and make perfect sense if you were sort of an eyewitness. See? If you were an eyewitness. And we've always characterized this, and the legal people have always looked at it and defended the documents of the New Testament as looking like they came from eyewitnesses and therefore would have some level of prima facie strength, right? So, for example, the head of the Harvard Law School for 50 years, Simon Greenleaf, the one who wrote the books on classic use of evidence in most of our textbooks. There's an apologetic school named after him in Los Angeles or San Diego because he was an outstanding Christian apologist. He wrote books called The Testimony of the Evangelist where he held legal canons against the New Testament, and the New Testament always comes up as a vindicated witness. So tons of books. A lot of the good apologetic stuff are written by legal authorities that apply good, practical argument to this thing to do it. Well, there's a new challenge that comes within the legal system called, it has to do with eyewitness testimony. In other words, how we all know that we have selective memory, especially when it's about commitments that we make to our kids or to our friends. There's loaned money, invoices, you know, bill dates, due dates. But, you know, we have selective memory. We understand how this works. And now it's got into the legal trade through a couple of legal foundations that are challenging the veracity of eyewitness testimony. So now there's a huge philosophical and epistemological problems within jurisprudence about the role of eyewitness testimony. How reliable is it? Should it be as given as much weight? So you can see how already out on the skeptical places on the web, there are arguments now against the New Testament reliability as being eyewitnesses with them, so what? Okay, so what? Eyewitnesses can be wrong. Here are cases where they're wrong. So you see there's a new sort of challenge coming up about, now, all of this eyewitness stuff right now is related to repressed memories, normally about abuse victims of childhood, about repressed memory. That's the context from which it comes. It doesn't take into effect the fact that you had a teacher during the resurrection times, for example. There's a lot of things that you don't that don't apply here. But it's a new challenge. It's just starting to come up. Bias in the New Testament is an age-old, I mean, that's been around for, you know, since 200 A.D., about bias in the New Testament documents. But it's still a very real issue, and like I say, it's come back up again, as to whether the evangelists were trying to out-argue somebody else. So, how many of you have ever read any of the apocryphal New Testament Gospels? Okay. And so, when you leave gaps, I remember the quiet years of Jesus, you know, from the time he's like up until he's 12, and then from 12 till he's 30. Those are called the quote-unquote lost years of Jesus. Once you get the New Testament, everybody wants to go fill these in with stories. The current one is, of course, that he traveled to India. He married Mary Magdalene, traveled to India, had three or four kids, divorced her, married somebody else, went to Rome. I got an email from somebody in Britain who said that Jesus had built some houses in the local area during those lost, seriously, I'm dead serious, you know, and invited me to go see their work site and everything in this site, their website about this. And so the Apocrypha fills these in with some of the strangest stories you've ever heard, right? And so they argue that, well, if writers could be this far off, so one of the apocryphal stories, Jesus is four or five years old. He goes up to a crowd of little kids. The little kids won't play with him. Mothers are all sitting there in the marketplace. Won't play. Turns them into goats. Jesus turns the little kids into goats. Goes to the mother and say, if you don't make them play with me, I'll keep them as goats. The mother agrees that we'll make a play. He turns them back into kids, and apparently they have a merry time under duress. Story about the Apostle John. The Apostle John, a very holy man, travels from city to city. He goes into a room to sleep for the night, orders all the bedbugs to congregate in that corner while he's going to sleep over here. That's an apocryphal piece of the New Testament. You get some sort of strange stories in this process, okay? But if they say if they could be this strange, why couldn't the New Testament writers have done this too? Right? See how the argument works? If people in the 4th century started twisting the stories around, okay, why do we assume that the people who literally were transformed by a risen Messiah wouldn't have done the same thing? Okay? And so that's how the argument sort of works. And the way you test that argument, of course, is you compare the data that you have here against every other piece of data that would, you know, tell you about conspiracy. You look at the data, how bad does it make the apostles look? All right. So the people that were writing this New Testament document, the Gospels, if you look in it, I mean, the apostles don't come off looking very bright, very committed, very loyal, very anything except sinful. Right? I mean, you get the story of the denial of Peter, you know, three, that's a, you know, the crowing of the rooster. You get Jesus consistently asking him, "Are you so slow on this one? I can't believe this. I can bring bread, and you're thinking I'm talking about food." Yeah, he goes through these things, and it just consistently, this is not what you would do if you were trying to honor your leaders with some fabricated lies. You'd have a different New Testament altogether if you were less committed to truth and more committed to political power and conspiracy. It'd be radically different. So, but we still have to deal with the eyewitness testimony issue. The scandal of particularity. Now, the scandal of particularity runs something like this. The thumbnail says, if God was so interested in saving the whole world, why did he do all of it? Why did he wait so long to do this in Palestine and keep it quiet among one little bitty country in the nation, in the world, and not go public with it earlier? In other words, why was this all done in the corner, so to speak, relative to the whole world, if God was interested in all this? And the scandal of particularity normally comes into the context of world religions and why wouldn't God skywrite his message in the sky every single morning when you get up? And there are common phrases like this that occur. We'll get to that one too as well. And a couple of comments I want to make on this. This is one of the bigger ones. For those of you that are in our very wide, let me mention a couple of books. The Supremacy of Christ. And I'll leave these up here. This is a Christian that basically works largely in the Eastern religion context, Buddhism, and to a lesser extent Hinduism. He's got some of the best material I've seen on that in understanding and working within that context. So if you're from that background or have questions in that area, you want to come get the titles on that. On the other side, in Western religion, Answering Islam, an Islamic guy and Dr. Norm Geisler together put this together. I know Talib, that's a pen name actually, quality piece of work here too. Again, if you're wrestling with these kind of issues, you want to deal with it. They have the closest system apologetics to ours that's available. Yes. The first one, if I can pronounce it, Ajith, Ajith Fernando. Okay. And then one that deals with most a wide panorama sort of what's going on in the faith, Christian faith and other faith. A little older work, Stephen Neill, Neill. It's more academic, but is one of the best sympathetic understanding of being able to articulate what are the real differences. Remember, I talked about level 10. At the level 10, it gets down to about a level 5 in terms of the real differences between Muslim and Christian, Jewish and Christian, pagan and Christian, whatever. Okay, so it covers a wider range of those, and I want to mention those. Now, I want to go spend a little bit of time on the scandal of particularity because there are a number of issues that are associated with it. The first thing you have to deal with on that is to recognize that the work of Christ, okay, is different than the message of the gospel. Okay? The work of what Christ came to do, remember, he didn't want everybody, remember, every time he converted somebody, he said, sit down and be quiet. I don't want you going out, don't tell anybody about this. But he had a certain work that he had to perform before he let it go, first of all. Okay? And because he kept telling the disciples, he said, look, I've got to go do this. What you hear in secret, what I tell you in secret, behind closed doors, once this occurs, then you go proclaim it. Once power has descended upon you from on high. So there was a time release with his story. But you got to remember that the book of Galatians says the gospel was preached unto Abraham. The gospel has been around since day one. See? The message of salvation, of a saving God who does whatever it takes to cover for our moral failures and inadequacies, has been around since God skinned the first animals in the garden and gave them clothes. It's been around since day one in various forms of precision. So Galatians says that God preached the gospel to Abraham saying, in you shall all nations of the earth be blessed. See? That was the content of the gospel to Abraham. How much precision is there in that about a future sacrifice? Not a lot. Not a lot, okay, if you think about it. How much did Abraham know about Jesus' day? He probably knew not a lot, but he knew some. He had some, but when he had to do the binding of Isaac, there's probably a point that was an object lesson to him. There's probably some disclosure there. We do know that he longed to look forward to the day of Christ, according to Jesus, but that might have been after he got up in heaven. See? Probably so. Okay. So there were disclosures, and I've got a large piece on the think tank if you want to check it out about what about those who have never heard the gospel. And what you always have come back to on this, several different cuts at this that we don't have time for. But you've got to recognize that two basic things. The picture we have up in heaven at the end of the days is there's a multitude that no person can number that are up there. If you consider historically half the world has died in infancy up until just the modern era, okay, and if you consider the fact that the God of all the earth will do right, okay, those set what we call boundary conditions around whatever local heresy you want to do about this. Okay, they're boundary conditions. It staggers the mind how much this information got out. And like I say, we don't know what kind of precision level was required. If Abraham was saved by believing that one of his descent, that the earth was going to be blessed through him, how much more precision did David have? Now, David probably had a lot more, right? Because he wrote Psalm 22. And Isaiah had considerably more. See what I'm saying? There's this progressive revelation thing that goes through the Scripture. But there's always a message of God breaking into history and doing something. A covenant God. Like I say, in 5 minutes we can't touch this very much. But there's a lot on this, and I encourage you to look at least at the piece that I had to work through on it in the think tank. So let me mention that to you. Watch my time here. The hiddenness of God. Number four is the hiddenness of God. Now this is the old skywriting thing. This is saying if God wanted us, I wanted everybody to really know, why didn't he write it in the sky every morning? And this is a very common way they say it, literally. It gets in, and then you start, remember my point about go for a level of detail? All right, there are 2,200 known languages that we know of that have more than 100 speakers in the world. The Bible has been translated into all but 200 of those, by the way. Everybody sort of has access to that aspect of Revelation. So if you were going to actually do what the skeptics suggest, you're going to have to write it at least 2,200 times in the sky, all over the sky. Remember, this is not a 3D thing. You've got to have it rolling with the sun as a... Okay, my point is, as you think through this, it becomes less and less sort of meaning. It loses all of its specificity. It just vapor. You can't get there from here. Let's put it that way. Right? And so then you say, what are the alternatives? Well, when you wake up, it's imprinted on the inside. Well, you say, well, you know, you got a separate problem there because that's completely takes away any vestige of free will you've got, right? And not that would accomplish very much anyway because we suppress truth as it is. You know, I mean, we do this every morning. Hold on one second. Let me get this book. Yeah.
Can you say that he does write it on the sky every morning?
Absolutely.
That
could be. That's right. There you go. Absolutely. It goes with the sunset. I mean, it shifts around. It's out of phase. Absolutely. You know, that reminds me, because when they ask these things, they do a lot of what's called category mistakes. They'll make a statement and not think through how it fits, right? And a category statement is where you use the wrong kind of context. So one of them is, a category mistake is, where was the man when he jumped off the bridge? It's a philosophical example. Where was the man when he jumped off the bridge? No, that's before he jumped. Now, that's after he jumped. See, the problem, you can't do this. This is an event with a win. You can't win this. The only right answer, he was beside himself. That's the only technically speaking correct answer to that, right, when he jumped off the bridge. But that's a category mistake in philosophy. Okay. Now, I want to read a section at the end of Luke 16. Luke 16 is one of the few pictures that we have of a dialogue of a after-death experience. You've got... rich man and Lazarus, dives in Lazarus. There was a rich man who was dressed in purple and fine linen and lived in luxury every day. At his gate was laid a beggar named Lazarus, covered with sores and longing to eat what fell from the rich man's table. Even the dogs came and licked the sores. The time came when the beggar died and the angels carried him to Abraham's side. The rich man also died and was buried. In hell, where he was in torment, he looked up and saw Abraham far away with Lazarus by his side. This is not the same Lazarus, by the way. So he called to him, Father Abraham, have pity on me and send Lazarus to dip the tip of his finger in water and cool my tongue, because I am in agony in this fire. But Abraham replied, Son, remember that in your lifetime you received your good things, while Lazarus received bad things. But now he is comforted here, and you are in agony. And besides all this, between us and you a great chasm has been fixed, so that those who want to go from here to you cannot, nor can anyone cross over from there to us. He answered him. This is the point. Then I beg you, Father, send Lazarus, this dead man, to my father's house, for I have five brothers. Let him warn them so that they will not also come to this place of torment. Abraham replied, they have Moses and the prophets, the Old Testament law. Let them listen to them. No, Father Abraham, he said, but if someone from the dead goes to them, they will repent. And Abraham said to him, if they do not listen to Moses and the prophets, they will not be convinced even if someone rises from the dead. Okay? Now, when Lazarus, the real Lazarus, was risen from the dead, when Jesus called him out, they had a feast. It said, some of them there praised God, and what did the other crowd do? Went off and told the Pharisees about this. Two completely different responses to the same exact miraculous event. What's wrong with this picture? Okay? Point being is that there are places where you just can't get. You just can't get there from here in terms of believing the data. It doesn't matter. It doesn't matter if there's a resurrection. You can come up with a way of explaining what the existentialists would say, I'm not a bit surprised that somebody rose from the dead. It's an absurd universe. Anything could happen. It has no force to them whatsoever. See what I'm saying? So, it wouldn't make a lot of difference if it was in 2,200 languages necessarily. Okay? It is written as I thought he was going originally. It is already written in the sky, Psalm 19. It's already written up there. There's plenty of arguments for design, understanding of this type. I brought a quote that I didn't cover the last time about how I mentioned secular cosmology, that they're scientists, agnostics, atheist kinds, are just getting to the point where they recognize that this thing was built by an intelligence. You know, it wasn't just a random kind of thing. And they're slowly getting to this point. And there's a quote by the agnostic Robert Jastrow from NASA. As he's seeing how this goes, he says, for the rationalistic scientist, and we may add philosopher, the story ends, smiled Jastrow, like a bad dream. And here's Jastrow's quote. Talking about the physicist, the secular scientist. He has scaled the mountains of ignorance. He is about to conquer the highest peak. As he pulls himself over the final rock, he is greeted by a band of theologians who have been sitting there for centuries. Right? It's a bad dream. It's a bad dream. Right? And that's just, like I said, this is where it's sort of looking. So the hiddenness of God, he's literally all around us. It's a function of to what extent do we respond, do we react, do we interact with this material? Again, it's a huge subtlety associated with that. We tend to suppress truth. Sometimes we make it up. Sometimes we don't. You know, there's a wide variety of why people respond the way they do. And it's not for lack of evidence. God has left his footprints all over history, all over history. Another theological one is the immense waste in the plan of God. This is the one that's one of the more troubling ones. I literally last night got an email. It greeted me this morning from Japan. Somebody had come through the think tank. It was Christian. And these are troublesome issues. I'm afraid to state the things which disturb me so because I'm afraid I will disturb your faith as well. Worry about it. And that's a legitimate, decent response. First, how can God be a God of justice, not to mention love, if only a select percentage of people are blessed enough to find the gospel? The man who struggles in this life without the peace of God has a greater chance for evil than a person who has come to know Jesus Christ. I mean, if I hadn't come to be a Christian, I would be much more violent and evil because I see no love in the world. Therefore, I'm handicapped. I would have been handicapped in the overall plan of salvation. More precisely, why are some people fortunate to find salvation and therefore redemption, while others do not and therefore fall prey to the power of sin and eternal destruction? Why does God only reveal himself to a select group of people? We're getting into the first thing we've talked about already. But the point here is that in the plan of God, however this thing worked out, it does look like there's a lot of waste in terms of what happened, in terms of the outcome. And when you look at this, the first thing you got to recognize is you can't hold God accountable for anything I'm supposed to be accountable for. I can't blame God. I can't sit there and say, I do wrong, it's your fault, the sovereignty thing. If I were to do that in the words of Apostle Paul, my condemnation would be just. Okay. And the point was, I can't literally hold him accountable for things that we're held accountable for. So there's a whole group of these things that I can't blame God on. When you look at pictures You don't see that picture we read of the rich man and Lazarus? He didn't say, nobody told me, or I didn't know, or there were no excuses. It was just very clear to everybody. There's no argument sort of up there. Because you got to remember that the judgment that God does is according to works. I mean, for the lost, those that have not bailed out of that problem, that radical dependence upon the cross of Christ, which is the only escape, you get exactly what you deserve. No more, no less. Exactly. And that's what most of us want to avoid, if at all possible. You know, in life, so many people sow wild oats and then pray for a crop failure. Right? Right? And what we're trying to do, what we have done, is we have fled. We have fled to the throne of mercy. That's what we've done. There's no hope. My old preacher, I told you about Nab Clark. I remember he got up one morning, a new believer, he came out of his preaching. He said, you know, I would just as soon trust my sins to get me to heaven as I would my righteousness. Right? He's preaching on all our righteousness are as filthy rags. And I remember thinking as a young Christian, that's a bit extreme comparison, isn't it? Well, after 25 years of acts of righteousness, I mean, I understand exactly what he's talking about. I understand exactly what he's talking about. We plead the blood because my good works and your good works did not die on the cross for us, right? And so the only object of trust is the person who did. So the waste in the plan of God, the problem there is, first of all, to what extent is he accountable for it? And secondly, how much is it? We don't know. Like I say, if you look at the scandal of particularity, evidence is really filled with a lot of folk. We don't know how this all plays out. But there's so much extra that we don't measure things by. I look at the measurement criteria of God and give up. I don't know how he makes these judgments that he does. When he says, you know, remember when James and John were trying to negotiate, or their mother was trying to negotiate for let them sit on the right hand and the left hand of you when they come into the kingdom? And Jesus said, that's not mine to give, that's for somebody else. Well, if you, mind test, think of who you think is going to be there. Most of you think of somebody like Paul, you know, St. Paul, or maybe Barnabas, or some saint like that, right? And I think, he's going to spin this around on us like he does everything else. It's going to be a single mom from Tibet, right? Raised one kid to glorify Jesus Christ, died 5 years in, that was it. No compromises, none. See, this is a different kind of model, how he judges things, right? Different approach to this kind of thing. So this is the God who has flowers grow in the rainforest that not a human is ever going to see. He likes flowers. Something's different about this God than the way we put him into this judge category. Something's different. It's the God who makes cinnamon and mustard and honeysuckle and sunset. You know, this is a different kind of God than the judge we try to make him into. Just the cold, stark, belligerent, pugnacious dude. So, waste in the plan of God, like I said, you got to back up and say, what are the real criteria here as to how we decide this? Philosophical, the problem of evil, especially innocent suffering, that's still a problem. We have an issue with innocent suffering. Emotionally, only because, or primarily because God does. He has a problem with innocent suffering. And like I say, that's going to provoke what's called the wrath of God in situations that when you read a story of child abuse or vandalism against the elderly, things of this type, your blood should boil. And that is such a tiny fraction of what it's really worth. What it's really worth. And it's, the wrath of God is not, shall we say, quiescent on this, or quiet on this issue of innocent suffering. There is a compensation, and you can't justify evil. Evil as essential nature is irrationality, so there are no quote-unquote reasons for it. It is essentially unreasonable. It is malice. It is, Augustine said, vandalism. It didn't make any sense. He just wanted to hurt something. He just wanted to destroy something beautiful. Sounds like an angelic being to me, right? Somebody that wants to just crush everything beautiful that God does. And in this, it shows up here in the problem of innocent suffering. One of the things that we do know is that innocent suffering, in some cases, does open our hearts to the gospel. In the choice and the plan of God, in Corinthians, he said, notice, among you, not many mighty, not many powerful, not many power-wielding people are among you, but God has chosen the foolish, the weak, the suffering of the world to be rich in the gospel. There's something there. It does sensitize us toward reality, and there's things about this that get associated with it. But it's still, like I say, it is an emotional problem because it's supposed to be. When you get into an innocent suffering problem, you've got to, I mean, for survival, you've got to quickly look at the cross. You've got to quickly look at the ultimate innocent sufferer who bore it all. I mean, you've got to go back there or else you get lost in the darkness so fast. There's no way out of this one. The thing that we trust God here is that the answer He will give us for this will blow us away. If I were an Old Testament saint and I was wondering how in the world God was going to be just and a justifier of me, a sinner, I'm going through this sacrificial ritual every day, this constant reminder that I'm not good enough for Him to dwell in my midst, every day being reminded by this. I'm wondering how in the world He's going to take a sinner and ever be in communion with God. The last solution I would ever come up with is that He would come to earth as an Israelite and die. That would be perfect resolution. He took it all on Himself. I get the righteousness of God in exchange for my sinfulness. Incredible solution. I have every reason in the world to believe that His problem to innocent suffering on the other end will be just as mind-blowing, just as provoking of worship, just as perfect as that was. This is a God we're talking about, and not just a big human. Okay, not just a big. This is a God, and all that word means. Okay, the last one is the philosophical, the question of existence, and this is not a difficult one existentially. It can bother you sometimes. I mean, but it's the philosophical. Why is there something rather than nothing? Basically, if you think about this, you can get trapped in this. You know, why is there something? You know, what without God? What was God before He created the universe? You know, does He have existence? Is He in some kind of context? I mean, we get mind-blowing at what was happening before the creation of the universe. Augustine tells a story of this pesky skeptic that was up there needling him about what God was doing before the foundation of the world. It was just sort of poking fun at Augustine's view of time. And eventually Augustine was trying to be gentle with him, and then finally he just gave up with this pesky person, and when the person asked the last time, what was God doing before the foundation of the world? He said He was preparing hell for the inquisitive. So the question of existence, like I say, it's difficult to step out of our context, which is we were created in this context. And so it's not a bothersome kind of problem. I mean, from a standpoint, it will trip you up every now and then. You'll get into what about the old science fiction things or what happens if our God is just a lower God in our universe and then there's a bigger God that has a bigger universe and He's the human, you know, and you'd go, you know, you can play with this all day long. It's just really weird. But existence will trip you up in some cases. So. All right, well, those are the seven. I mean, there are so many more than that. We have about 45 seconds to cover apologetics and evangelism. And the main point I want to make here is that apologetics is not evangelism. It is not evangelism. It is a good work. And so people will get an argument between the evidentialist and the presuppositionalist over, well, you're relying upon logic to convert the unsaved, and they can't do this, right? And then the evidentialist will go over here and say, well, wait a minute, but Jesus used evidence, used all these arguments, so did Paul. Can't be wrong. And they're just not talking to one another. They're just not at the same table of discussion. The point is that's not what apologetics is about. Apologetics is just answering somebody. If they say, give me bread, you give them bread instead of give them the gospel all the time. I mean, this is what James is about, right? You say, depart from me, be ye filled. You don't give them bread, it doesn't work. And there's a point where somebody's just hurting so bad with a question, just eaten up. I mean, why did God make mosquitoes? He'll eat you up sometimes, right? And he's just not necessarily rational, not out of balance.